ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've just come back from a recent holiday overseas or interstate, you probably hired one of these. And if that's the case, there's also a good chance that the vehicle you rented was made in China, even if you didn't realise it at the time. China now has the largest domestic car market in the world. It's the biggest exporter of cars, and it also happens to be the world's biggest manufacturer of vehicles. And just a few weeks ago, the Chinese company BYD overtook Tesla as the world's top electric vehicle seller. But it hasn't always been that way.
China was known as the land of bicycles, right? There was barely any private cars, and even taxis were rare. And then we've moved to a country that in the 90s and early 2000s that looked a lot more like Southeast Asia, where most of the cars were still fleets, right? Like taxis, to one where private ownership has become much more common in first-tier cities in China, the largest cities.
This is the story of how China came to dominate the global automobile industry. And politics, innovative thinking, the underestimation of rivals, and plain old good luck made it all happen. Hello and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Anthony Fennell. Let's start our analysis with Ilaria Mazzocco, an expert in Chinese business and economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
So exports from China of cars, both internal combustion engine and electric vehicles, have really grown dramatically. And I think just looking at China's position as an exporter over the past 5 years, we can see how that's changed, right? So in 2020, China was the fifth largest exporter of cars. It is now the first in terms of, you know, just numbers of vehicles. So that's been a very dramatic shift in just a few years. We're seeing a lot of diversification, especially in emerging markets. But the European Union is also a big market. Certainly Australia, for example, is also a market as well. So we're seeing the very diversified sort of approach. There's been multiple trends that have converged to create the current situation. So on the one hand, with electric vehicles, there's definitely been sort of a lot of industrial policy, and the government has pushed this technology. And I think, you know, they certainly aspire to become exporters. So I think we can talk about a strategy there. With internal combustion engine vehicles, I think this is more of a result of rapid shifts within the Chinese market, which is the biggest auto market in the world, and has now shifted very rapidly to electric vehicles. Again, if you look at 2020, less than 10% of new car sales were electric vehicles. Now it's around 50%, right? So that's really created a huge shift in the market, and it's pushed automakers, including a lot of Western automakers that make cars in China, to export more internationally. So I think there's just been these convergence of different factors where some has been strategy and other things have been sort of market dynamics and companies' responses.
Another thing that's changed is that Chinese technology, cars included, are no longer sneered at in the way they once were. Freelance business journalist Dr. Tessa Thornley.
Made in China used to be, you know, a kind of low cost, not great quality, and that was what it was synonymous with. And that has certainly shifted. I used to live in China, and back in about 2011, 2012, I used to drive a BYD car, a BYD SUV, and I was teased quite ruthlessly by both my expatriate friends and my Chinese friends. It was described as a little bit like driving a lawnmower. And since then, obviously the brand has developed, you know, there's been a massive international drive. But what's happening now, and the way the cars are being manufactured and what the technology involves, is so very different to back then. And it's been a real brand success story, the international expansion for BYD. You know, what started off as really a battery company that put a shell of a car around a battery is now something completely different. For example, in the UK recently, Auto Trader, which is a magazine, the car was voted the UK's most loved car brand above brands like Porsche and Mini. Consumers are really happy with buying a Chinese brand. They love the safety record. They love the affordability. They love the speed with which the cars can be developed against, you know, some of the Western brands. These are all things that, you know, consumers really enjoy about Chinese brands now.
So what does the Chinese auto sector actually look like? It's estimated there are somewhere between 100 to 150 active car manufacturers in China, though the figures tend to vary depending on who you're speaking to. Let's just say there's a lot. Then there are the familiar Western brands that are now owned by Chinese companies, MG and Volvo. There's Tesla also, which builds many of its cars in the People's Republic. And then there are what's known as the joint venture companies. The joint venture approach to car making arose during the economic reforms instigated by China's former paramount leader, Deng Xiaoping, in the late 70s, 80s and into the 90s.
Well, I mean, if you look back to those times, the obvious reason for the joint ventures was really a lack of knowledge on the China side of the foreign market. There weren't a huge number of Chinese companies, you know, two decades ago with a significant international footprint. And the JVs were a way of them getting the toe in the pond and seeing what would work and what wouldn't work without huge investment that could backfire. So the JVs, to an extent, were necessary at a time when knowledge and information was less.
The Chinese economy started opening up to foreign investment and the West, really, you know, at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, really. And so you started seeing sort of mandated joint ventures for car companies, Western car companies that wanted to enter the Chinese market. And those joint ventures are still in place today in many cases, right? So if you look at the biggest car makers globally, you know, Volkswagen, they still have joint ventures and partnerships in China, which are the result of that legacy. But what happened over time was that, yes, these partnerships brought cars to China that were manufactured in China, brought more passenger vehicles to Chinese consumers, but they weren't really resulting in great leaps in technological advancement. So to put it in other words, the Chinese partners weren't necessarily acquiring all that technology that the Chinese government had hoped would be transferred as part of the joint ventures. In fact, ironically, the companies that maybe were more creative and advancing more quickly were the sort of private Chinese companies that were really more sidelined, like Geely, for example, which ended up buying Volvo, for example. That was sort of the story throughout the 90s and even throughout, you know, early 2000s. And so that brings us to a moment in which this idea started emerging within certain parts of the Chinese bureaucracy. I would say, you know, initially this was really more of a pet project that really China should leapfrog and move on to the next technology and acquire sort of IP in an area where there weren't as many established players and sort of leverage its market to then really make it the dominant technology. And that's, I think, what we've seen happen with electric vehicles.
Which brings us to a senior Chinese official named Wang Gang and the role he played in China's pivot to electric. I'll let Zai Yang explain. Zai is a technology journalist and senior writer at Wired magazine.
Yeah, this was a really interesting part of the story because this is where you feel like actually some important historical figure can change how the industry goes and where we are. So Wang Gang was at that time, I think around 2008, the minister of China's, I think it's Industry International Informational Technology. And he was a trained auto engineer. He used to work in Europe for one of the European car makers for a long time. And so when he became the head of industry development in China, he believes that China has a possible future in becoming the leader of automotive technology. And also, he was personally very invested in the idea of electric vehicles too, which is why when Tesla released this very first electric vehicle model, the Roadster, back in 2008, Wang Gang, he personally drove that vehicle, and I assume he really enjoyed it. That's why he believed that, okay, we already see a prototype here. We know it could work. Let's figure out how to mass produce it in China.
And that decision was matched with financial and political support, not just from the central government in Beijing, but also from many regional governments, keen to project an image as forward-looking and innovative.
You know, I think if we really go back to, you know, the late 1990s, the early 2000s, what we need to know is that at the time, China already has the capacity to make cars, thanks to some foreign investment in some domestic companies. But then at the time, the cars they are made in China are considered to be inferior than the foreign cars. They're considered to be not of good quality. But also, automotive industry is so important that the Chinese government wants to figure out to make their way in. So really, for them at the time, electric vehicles just emerge as a alternative, right? It's like, what if all the cars in the future will be powered by electricity and it doesn't require an internal combustion engine anymore? Does that mean we can actually leapfrog to the leading edge of that technology if we start to invest early? So what we're seeing is that starting in the early 2000s, Chinese governments really started subsidizing like scientific research that probes, oh, maybe that is actually possible in the future. Or they started to also subsidizing companies that experiment in, let's make batteries, let's make electric vehicles. And that really over the two decades turns into this very vibrant domestic market for electric vehicles where Chinese brands produce really capable cars that consumers like to buy. And that is what we're seeing today.
It seems obvious in retrospect to focus on EV manufacturing, but it was a risky strategy in lots of ways, wasn't it?
It was, because no one knew that like batteries really will become energy dense enough to power a car, right? Because in the beginning, the big problem really is that batteries are too heavy. And if you need to put a battery that can keep a car running for example, hundreds of kilometers on the road, then it will be too heavy that no car will ever hold that. So the progression of the technology is that they're making batteries more and more efficient so that they can become a viable source of energy for any car. And that takes a long time. And no one in the beginning could say this is definitely going to happen for sure. But it really does take a lot of the hard work by Chinese scientists and companies to work on mass producing those batteries to prove that actually, yes, this can become true.
And that focus on EVs and on developing battery technology, superior battery technology, it really gave them a jump, didn't it, on the European and American competitors particularly?
Yeah, I think one thing to know is that I think at the time, even Chinese companies and the Chinese government know that if we're still competing in the traditional car technologies, the internal combustion engine, there's no way for us to come ahead, because the American companies, the European car makers, and the Japanese and Korean car makers are just so far ahead. They are much better at making those combustion engines and making them more affordably, that the Chinese companies just have no hope. But then, because electric vehicles are very different, like right now for electric vehicle, I think almost half of the cost of that car is just in its battery. So it means that if you can master the cost benefits of a battery, it really puts you ahead a lot of other places. But then the other thing to know is that at the time, why the other car makers in Japan, in Germany, are not as incentivized, it's the same thing, because they feel that we're already leading in gas cars. Why do we have to invest so much in a technology that may never come true one day? So in that way, they don't have incentive to really try to find the alternative there.
So in that sense, it's really a classic case, isn't it, of a disruptor coming into a very conservative market?
Yeah, that's true. And I think China benefits from another aspect in that it already makes cars for a lot of foreign brands. So that means that they have the suppliers, they have the factories, they have workers who know how to put together the other parts of a car that's not a battery. So when they actually have the leading technology in batteries and combine that with their traditional manufacturing might, that really makes making a car possible.
The highly competitive nature of the Chinese EV market has absolutely sharpened the abilities of these companies to maneuver well, nimbly, flexibly, at lower cost, highly competitively. And EV adoption in China being so strongly supported encouraged a lot of investment and encouraged a lot of the technological advances. Obviously, that has been a help to those companies too and will help them abroad.
Tessa Thornalley again. And you're listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, we're looking at the conditions and decisions that propelled China from a land of bicycles to the world's leading automobile manufacturer and exporter. Now, what's been just as interesting as the rapid rise of China's car industry has been the reaction of its competitors. Here's the story of Jim Farley, as told to us by Mike Colias, the US Autos editor for Reuters.
Well, Jim Farley's a longtime Ford executive. He was actually at Toyota before that. Longtime marketing executive for those two companies. Real passionate about vehicles and features and what consumers want. You know, he's got a real eye for the market. He rose through the ranks at Ford, eventually became CEO in 2020. He had an experience that I think a lot of the global auto executives have had since China reopened after COVID. And he went back in on a trip early 2023 or 2024, and he was just blown away at the progress that the Chinese automakers had made. You know, Ford, like just about every big major Western car company, had partnered with a few Chinese JV players, you know, decades ago. And it was always a big brother, little brother kind of situation. And, you know, a company like Ford would sort of like help their Chinese counterparts understand engineering and understand quality. And, you know, they'd learn from the Chinese partners too. But it was always, you know, Ford had the upper hand in that relationship, right? And so he goes back in and sees what this partner had come up with in terms of these electric vehicles that were half the price of what Ford would charge in the US, and it had longer charging range and it had more features and better technology. And when he was over there, he took a test drive of a few of these electric cars around a track, and sitting shotgun was his CFO, and he got done and they looked at each other and he said, "This is completely unlike it was before. Like, we're going to lose if we're competing against these cars all over the world at a cost basis that we can't even comprehend." So he came back freaked out. And when he got back to Michigan, he had some cars sent over from China and put them right in lobby, essentially, and had his executives, and there was a board meeting at the time. He had them come through, sit in it, you know, play with the features, see how good this is. This is what we're up against. From then on, he wanted to figure out, okay, how do they get this quality at such a low cost? And so they did their dissections. And one of the takeaways was, we're going to have to figure out their supply chain. We're going to have to pick through the Chinese supply chain and try to figure out how to compete against these guys on cost, or else we're going to lose.
And it seems there was also a sense of deja vu in the way Jim Farley was thinking.
Here comes the unstoppable Big Six, the Toyota Land Cruiser. World's toughest four-wheel drive. There's no stopping a Toyota. It's the toughest, guttiest, keep-goingest power package ever built into a four-wheel drive.
You know, coming from Toyota, his having started his career at Toyota and just being a student of the industry, he saw the Japanese and other Asian automakers come into the U.S. market in the 70s and 80s and really humble the big Detroit companies, which had dominant market share at the time. And over the span of just a few decades, quality, fuel-efficient cars that the Japanese were bringing in and eventually set up domestic operations. And now, you know, Toyota and Ford are neck and neck in market share. So yeah, I think his quote was, he's seen this movie before. And, you know, he doesn't think the Chinese are going to be setting up operations in the U.S. tomorrow. He knows that there's geopolitical and other reasons why that's unlikely. But eventually, the consumers are going to demand it. If there's quality product at a lower price, he knows he's going to need to compete against that eventually.
It's been interesting to watch, because actually every car maker has had a slightly different approach, right? You've had car makers that have doubled down on their R&D in China, others who have largely sort of given up on the Chinese market. And then you've had others who are really sort of trying to rethink what their strategy is in third markets, where Chinese EVs have done a lot better than many expected. Look at Southeast Asia, for example, where EV adoption is much higher than anybody really had forecast. Assuming that there isn't going to be a transition to EVs would be wishful thinking. Markets like the United States are probably going to progress a lot slower than the European Union, but, you know, these are going to be really important technologies. So I think, you know, every car maker is going to have to come up with their own strategy. It's probably going to be dependent on which markets they're going to privilege. But I think in a way for consumers, the positive story is the Chinese car makers are pushing innovation forward. But of course, there is a geopolitical element here where a lot of governments are concerned that there may be an overdependence on China, especially, I would say, for components, which, you know, if you look at batteries, Chinese companies are really, really important there in that value chain.
And in terms of the attitude of the United States towards Chinese imports, is the United States market, is it actually seen by China as important, or have they really just kind of put it to the side because they've got so much more interest from other countries and other parts of the world?
I mean, the United States is still the second largest automotive market in the world, and one where you could make a lot of profits, right? Cars sold here are, on average, more expensive than a lot of other markets around the world. So I think if it were available to them, Chinese car makers would be very, very happy to access the U.S. market. But I think most of them are realistic that this is highly unlikely anytime soon. You know, this is, you know, a fairly bipartisan issue where, you know, protecting U.S.-based manufacturers is a priority. And also, I think there's a lot of national security concerns that remain unaddressed.
Ilaria Motsoko. Now, it's impossible to talk about the evolution of modern cars without mentioning Tesla. Tesla may be an American-owned company, but it has a significant presence in China, and it's also played a part in the rise of the Chinese car industry.
So Tesla right now has one factory in China. It's in Shanghai. And this factory accounts for over half of the cars that Tesla makes every year. I think they're mostly supplying for domestic demand in China, in other parts of Asia, and in some parts of Europe. So this is interesting because all of these foreign car makers came into China were basically forced to open up a joint venture with a Chinese company. But Tesla was the first example where they did not do that. They just came in, built up their own factory, and was able to be the sole owner of those factories and those profits. So I think Tesla really came in at a time where China was already seeing some progress in electric vehicles. Like they have some domestic competitors, but those cars are not very profitable. Those cars are not very desired in the market. Whereas Tesla was seen, and probably still is today, seen as like this example of like the most popular electric vehicles that almost everyone has some desire to buy. So when that happens, and when Tesla expresses the interest to maybe move some of the manufacturing in China, I think what Chinese government sees as an opportunity is that this is the company that will teach our other car companies how to make an electric vehicle that's really popular in the market. And also, again, it will contribute to employment, it will contribute to taxation, everything that the government would like to see. So at the time, the local Shanghai government really fast-tracked everything to make sure Tesla can build up a factory there very fast. And again, what we're seeing is that because Tesla established such a strong and scalable supply chain there, it trained a lot of Chinese suppliers into knowing that how do I make a car part that's of the top quality that can work for electric vehicle. But it also really inspires the competition in China because all of this Chinese electric vehicle who used to be protected by this kind of like lack of market access for Tesla now has to put their product directly against Tesla's for a Chinese consumer. Everyone's going to compare that, okay, if Tesla looks better and drives better, why would I even consider buying a Chinese car? So all of these Chinese cars are forced to innovate to make their cars more affordable and more appealing to Chinese customers. And in the end, I would say most of them have done it. They have figured out some ways to have some edges over Tesla.
And ironically, with Tesla, its main competitor now is BYD, Build Your Dreams, which is a Chinese brand. So Tesla helped build the Chinese industry, but it also built its own competitor, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think one thing we really need to consider is that Tesla hasn't been that innovative when it comes to introducing a large portfolio of different kinds of cars. And that's what a lot of Chinese companies, especially BYD, saw the opportunity. They said, okay, what if I introduce a car model that's much cheaper than any car that Tesla sells? Of course, there's a market for that. What if I introduce a car that's more multifunction and more expensive and luxurious than any car Tesla sells? There's another market for that. So by customizing cars for every kind of niche market in there, they were able to capture a lot of those markets that Tesla couldn't get.
I think there are several factors that have given China roughly a 30% cost advantage on electric vehicles. One is just the scope of the supply chain, the minerals that are used in the batteries that are by far the most costly component of an electric car. Most of those either are mined in China or processed. They dominate the globe when it comes to processing things like nickel or graphite or lithium. They've got advantages in just the basic commodity auto parts supply chain. China has always been able to make things, even just like small steel parts that are commoditized, just a little bit cheaper than a company in Europe or the US. I'm sure labor's a factor. I'm sure government support's a factor. I mean, all these things have gone into this advantage that China has really been able to leverage over the last, especially 5 to 7 years, as they've pivoted toward electric vehicles.
So given the rapid growth of the last decade and a half, the rise of the Chinese car industry might seem unstoppable. Well, not quite. Because the boom in exports, while on the surface of it a very good thing for China, also reflects a significant long-term structural problem. The problem of overproduction and overcapacity.
During that period of build-out, when all these JVs started, you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, millions of cars worth of factory space was built during that time. The foreign company would come in and spend the money to do that. The Chinese partner would help. But all of that capacity really was internal combustion. That was for gas and diesel engine cars. And so what you've seen go in terms of factory space in the last 7 to 10 years is battery cell plants, electric vehicle plants. And so now you've got roughly 50 million cars worth of factory space in China. That's how much they could produce in a given year if they wanted to, for a market that's only about half that. And so, you know, they're not building 50 million, but they're building a lot more cars than the market needs. And that's why you're seeing this export surge. A few years ago, China surpassed Japan as the biggest exporter of cars. And that number is just going up and up and up. And it's because there's nowhere for these cars to go. They're making too many. And so they're pumping them out to the rest of the world. And many of them are gas cars. Chinese consumer wants the electrics generally. And so a lot of the surplus is gas cars going to places like Europe and Latin America.
Is it inevitable then that there will be some kind of rationalization of the domestic Chinese car industry? Are we actually seeing that happen at the moment?
You know, they're seeing some real irrational behavior, like taking brand new cars and declaring them as used and then selling them overseas, even though they've got zero mileage. You know, like these clearinghouses of cars that aren't dealerships, but they're just kind of like this middle market has emerged to move these cars because they're just, you know, 40, 50% off, you know, fire sale on vehicles. And so you've started to see some resistance to that and some warnings from regulators, you know, or do we have another real estate crisis on our hands like China went through a few years ago? But the problem is you should have seen a shakeout by now, right? And I don't think a shakeout would work in China quite like it would work in the US, where the weaker players would just go insolvent and declare bankruptcy. In a lot of cases, the local car company is tied to that local, you know, provincial government. And there's been investment from the government into these companies. And I think it's a lot harder for that shakeout to happen in a place like China. So you're continuing to see, you know, 100 some car companies operate, almost all of which are losing money. The dealers are starting to lose money. The suppliers are under pressure. But in terms of how that's going to resolve itself, it's unclear.
Basically, what tends to happen in China is that once the government identifies a strategic industry, you tend to get a lot of investment. Often it's facilitated by local governments. There might be even competing amongst each other. So we've seen this in the electric vehicle sector. And this has, you know, been good for innovation because there's been so much competition that a lot of companies have been really focused on sort of outcompeting and providing a lower cost to consumers. But it's led to what the Chinese government now defines as involution. So very lower margins, even deflation in some cases, which means that for companies, it may actually be unsustainable to continue to reinvest in R&D and even to continue to, you know, be in business without receiving some government support. So I think that's partly where we are at now in the EV industry. We have very good products. They're highly competitive, and yet they are the product of an industry that continues to have these weaknesses within it. So I think that's really something that the Chinese government is at the same time very proud of and very worried about.
Ilaria Motsoko from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And before her, Mike Colias, the US Autos Editor for Reuters. And you've been listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC News Radio and CBC Canada. Next week, the turbulent history of Bangladesh. This month, the country will hold what many are hoping will be its first free election in over 18 years, and the stakes are high. So make sure you tune in for that. I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks for joining me. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.